Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes, and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did. Ariel's bad boyfriend pulls up behind them in his pickup truck. And we start to see that Ariel is not this goody two shoes buttoned up pastor's daughter that we thought she might be. She is wild and she gets around.
Hello world, is a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation whose anxiety began with the game Perfection.
Yikes. We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we're saving the music that saved dance in Beaumont, the soundtrack to the movie Footloose.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists. Very first drum hit, the soundtrack of Footloose, isn't just playing in the background. It's basically grabbing you by the collar and saying, pay attention. It pushes this movie forward, stomping its way through every scene. This movie doesn't work without the music. These songs tell us how suffocating this town is, how restless and trapped these kids feel, and how dancing ultimately saves them. And all of it was very intentional. Besides apparently being sponsored by Coke, did you guys notice all the obvious product placement in this movie? Coke cans, Coke signs everywhere. We could say this movie is sponsored by Dean Pitchford, the real MVP, who is not only the screenwriter, but co-wrote all 9 songs on the OG soundtrack.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? And lots of our favorite films from the 80s use a soundtrack as background noise, but Footloose takes this to the next level. That soundtrack made the music as much of a part of the movie as the plot. Don't you agree?
100%.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't, it's almost like you can't have one without the other.
Right.
Each iconic track serves as more than just a catchy melody. It defines the characters' identities and it fuels this high-stakes battle for self-expression. And as I just said, this was all very intentional thanks to the movie's true hero, not Kevin Bacon, Dean Pitchford.
That's right.
Yep. Right? We're going to probably talk a little bit more about Dean Pitchford. There's a great video on YouTube called The Making of Footloose. And in it, Dean Pitchford says, I wrote the screenplay to Footloose, and so I wasn't just going to throw my hands up and walk away from it as a songwriter, nor was I going to stick the songs in there to sort of fill the gaps. I basically asked myself two questions whenever I wrote a song for a scene. One was, whose song is this? Oh, and the second question was, what are they singing about? What do they want?
Oh, wow.
I know.
That's pretty brilliant, actually.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Because all the songs are different. And so that's why, whose song is this? That has many, many... Did I just totally interrupt you? Sorry.
No. Go for it.
When you first said, whose song is this? My first thought was, which performer, like which singer is this? And then I was like, oh, no, she means which character.
Right.
But it still works on both levels, because even though Dean Pitchford co-wrote all 9 songs, every song is different. They're all like different genres. It's incredible.
Yeah. And Dean Pitchford says they actually, this one's going to blow your mind, you guys. Are you wearing hats?
Okay.
Just kidding. Mm-hmm. Dean Pitchford says they actually cast the movie based on the voices of the vocalists.
Wait.
Okay. Whoa, so listen, what? I'm going to keep going. Okay. Like he said, it was like they were casting for a Disney animated movie. The voice of the singers were the subconscious voices of the actors. Like Kenny Loggins was Kevin Bacon or vice versa.
Yeah.
He said, it's like a musical where the characters don't sing. So think of it. That's a musical, but the movie character is just not the one doing the singing.
They're speaking for the character.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're speaking for the character.
It's so intentional. Yeah. And so today, listeners, we'll be talking about this, how the Footloose soundtrack doesn't just set the vibe of the movie, but drives the story, fuels the conflict, and became a bit of a battle cry for us Gen Xers.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen, what is your, like, what's your connection with this? What are your memories?
This was a for sure in the theater experience for me. I went with a big group of dancers, of course.
Yeah.
I went with a big group of dancers and we stood in line at the Anoka Theater in downtown Anoka to watch Kevin Bacon. And then when we left, everyone was in love with Kevin Bacon. And my friend Patty started going, jump back. Every time you'd say something, she'd go, jump back. Like that was her new thing after seeing Footloose, which is Kevin Bacon's like big city, big city idiom. Jump back.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was last week years old when I actually saw the movie for the
first time. I can't believe this. I can't believe we're still letting you sit here with us today.
I can't believe you're not revoking my Gen X card and kicking me off the podcast. But again, when I do a little of the research and look at the timeline, this would have been February of my freshman year of college when the movie when does the movie come out?
Mm-hmm. 1984.
Four, right. Mm-hmm. And so we...
February 17th. So that was just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. So one, I'm at college. Two, nobody has a car.
No.
And we would have had to have gotten in a car and driven to a movie theater. And I think I've shared before, I can probably count on one hand how many times I actually went to a movie theater while I was in college to see a movie. But you guys... I knew every one of those songs. I danced every one of those songs at all school parties all that spring. So when I was watching this movie last week, I was like, what?
And you didn't know. You had no idea.
I had no idea. Like, I thought, that's not from Top Gun. I thought that was from Top Gun. Literally, I thought some of these were just standalone hits. I had no idea. It was like I was getting whiplash. Every time a song would come on, I had to like pause the movie and just be like, my whole vision of the song and the narrative in my head had to change because this wasn't Denise Williams' just cute video that I saw on MTV.
Mm-hmm. What's so interesting about that, so to me, Carolyn, is like this is one of my favorite 80s movies for sure. I mean, you guys know how I feel about Pretty in Pink, but this and Dirty Dancing, but Footloose is right up there. And I don't get sick of it. Now, I don't watch it all the time. And when I watched it again a couple of weeks ago, I hadn't seen it in probably, 15, 20 years. But I love it so much. I credit most of it to the soundtrack, to it together. But ever since 1984, when I hear any of those songs, Holding Out for a Hero, anything, I picture the scene from the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Always. So you never have done that.
No. I think I thought Holding Out for a Hero was from Top Gun. So I think I probably had, Tom Cruise in my head.
He's in Shrek, too, I think.
Yeah. but I just never... Yeah, so I never had a visual from the movie to go with the song.
Well, I was going to tell you something really funny. When I watched it, Brian and I watched it together because he loves this movie too, a couple of weeks ago. And when it was over, I just looked at him. I was like, it's so good. And I said, I can't believe Carolyn has never seen it. And I'm so excited for her to see it. And I'm so excited to know what she thinks. And Brian just deadpan looks at me and he goes, she'll probably feel bad for the guy in the truck.
Oh!
Listeners, that's a little nod back because Carolyn had never seen Pretty in Pink, and she came to the discussion ready to defend Steph.
I will stand by Steph.
But we have to wonder if she's going to defend Chuck.
No, I'm not going to defend Chuck.
You know for sure that Chuck has some daddy issues. He and Steph are the same person. They're the same person.
No. That's a different.
Okay, yeah, that's a different conversation.
To your corners. We're going to save that for another one.
That's right. But I do want to say, like, if I could just have a second about the movie, because very soon into the movie, obviously I know Kevin Bacon is in it. I know that John Lithgow is in it. I know the singer girl. I mean, I just know her
Ariel.
Name.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea until last week that Sarah Jessica Parker was in it.
Yeah.
No idea. Yeah. And then there's Ren's mother. And I kept going, who is it?
Oh,
is it?
It's the plumber.
I come to fix the sink.
Believe it or not, it's not the plumber. She was the mom from Apple's Way.
Oh my God. Oh, my God.
I know.
Oh, my God.
And I never saw Apple's Way, so I didn't
get
that.
So you never would have those moments. But, like, I felt really calm when she was on. I was like, she's a good one. But as I was watching it, I just thought, again, who is this person? How do I know it? And, you guys, is like a quintessential Gen X movie mom, because she was a mom in Gremlins, Back to the Future, and Stand By Me.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Okay, that's why she looks familiar to me.
And when you said Apple's Way, there was like a little explosion that went off in my head.
I could see
it. It was so immediate that I was like, of course. And I couldn't tell you her name or anything.
I couldn't have either.
I just thought she was so familiar. I just thought because she was a character actress. Like, oh, certainly she's been in a lot of things. I never could have pulled out Apple's Way.
I know. And you know
Good job.
You probably couldn't have pulled out this one. And this will be my last fun fact about Frances Lee McClain. She also starred in the CBS TV movie of the week, No Other Love. That starred Richard Thomas and Julie Kavner. It was kind of like the Sean Cassidy, Linda Pearl movie.
Like Normal People.
But it was called No Other Love. So there you go. A little Gen X
fun fact. Another one we will never talk about. We're never going to talk about that movie.
We don't want to
touch
those.
Just Google it.
We can't do it.
John Boy and Rhoda's sister. It just like CBS
and Marge Simpson. John Boy and Marge Simpson.
That's like your you could invite three people to dinner. Who's it going to be? Let's see. Marge Simpson, John Boy, and Jesus. Well, let's just talk. Just for a couple more minutes, let's talk about the movie, because while it was a huge favorite of so many of us Gen Xers and spoke to us, it still holds up, I think, and it's relevant in this day. What do you guys think?
It was hard to watch this movie at this moment in history. I have to be honest with you. When you see it in 1984, it's sort of like a fairy tale of something that could happen in this far off land, but it would never touch you. And when you watch it today, you're like, shit, that's happening right now.
It's censorship, basically, of your self-expression.
And this divide of the city people versus the small town people. Mm-hmm. And it's turned up to 11. And it was more relevant today than it was in 1984.
Yeah. And I thought, actually, again, because I hadn't seen it until last week, that I had to actually look it up, because I thought it was set in the 50s at first. Like, when I looked at, you know, the first scene is there in church and it's Sunday. And if you go and look at what the girls are wearing, I mean, they have like cardigans on and button down shirts. He's the only one that looks like, and I bet this was certainly intentional, because he's got like the skinny tie on and like the kind of unstructured blazer. But between what the girls are wearing, and then she's like, we're going to go to get a soda at the icebox.
True. Yeah.
And it's like this kind of happy-go-lucky, almost feel like this town is stuck in another time. And it wasn't really until probably one of the scenes where I saw cars that I thought, okay, that's now. But
they
never even got the feeling of it being in the 80s based on what this town was like stuck in.
Well, and, you know, the movie is based on a true story that had just happened a couple of years before. So in the early 80s in Oklahoma, the fictional town of, this in the movie, it's taking place in Beaumont. It's supposed to be Utah. But It actually, this all is a true story. Wow. This is all based on a true story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Scary.
It was directed by Herbert Ross. It opened at number one, and it was at the time, let's just everybody hear that. At the time, it was the highest grossing February release in film history.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty big. So then tell me this, riddle me this, listeners and Carolyn and Kristen, how does this movie to this day only have a 55% on Rotten Tomatoes?
No, come on.
Yes, it does.
What mm-hmm. the hell? Why? What do they say?
Exactly. That's riddle
this
me
was
this.
A crowd this was such a crowd pleaser. Like there was nobody that was like, it was fine. Everybody was running
we
to see Footloose. We loved it.
And yes, the cast. And Carolyn, you just said most of them. But, you know, I'll just Kevin Bacon, Laurie Singer, Chris Penn, John Lithgow, Diane Wiest, Sarah Jessica Parker, among a lot of other mm-hmm.
Frances
faces
Lee McClain.
Yes, Frances, that she would remember. That she would go, who is it? So you've got this powerhouse cast.
Yeah.
You've got this incredible soundtrack. You've got a really tight, I think, great story. Mm-hmm. You've got good writing. I don't know. I don't get it.
I have my feelings about what it could be.
Okay. Well.
I think it's Laurie Singer.
Well, there's no denying that what Dean Pitchford and his crew set out to do was a success. And the Footloose soundtrack played an enormous part of it. It hit number one on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart by April. Do you guys want to guess what album it knocked off? April of 84. It knocked something off. It was Thriller. Good mm-hmm. job, Kristen.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
You get to wear the pop culture crown. Mm-hmm,
the crown. I got the crown.
Yeah. And it held that position for 10 weeks. And it contained 6 Billboard Hot 100 top 40 hits. 3 of those reached the top 10. And one of the reasons this soundtrack did play such a huge part of the movie's success is because the soundtrack was released a couple of weeks before the movie. The soundtrack was released on January 27th, 1984. The movie was released on February 17th, 1984. And fun fact, listeners, we're actually recording this episode right now. It is February 17th. We're witches.
Not on purpose.
We do this all the time.
Not on purpose. We are pop culture witches.
I know. You're listening to it, you know, mm-hmm. in the future, a couple of weeks. But still, so we're all celebrating basically 42 years of Footloose. But yeah, so the soundtrack was released before the movie, as well as the video, the official Footloose video. Now, Kevin Bacon says in that that little YouTube video, The Making of Footloose, and I'll put a link to that in this week's Weekly Reader because it's super good. He says MTV really launched this movie because the video for Footloose is just a bunch of clips from the movie. Kenny Loggins isn't even in it at all.
It's like a big trailer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So audiences knew. Yeah, exactly. It's like a 3.5-minute trailer. Audiences
and they don't
knew.
Have to pay for it. They don't have to. It's not an advertisement.
Oh, yeah.
They give the video to MTV and then MTV plays it for free. Yeah. They don't have to pay for ad space.
You see so many great scenes set to this amazing song that I'll tell you about just in a minute, you know, that obviously written for the movie. And so they are like, I want more. I want more. So he says they couldn't believe that the lines were around the block when the movie premiered because everybody had seen all the dancing. They had seen the prom, you know, part of the prom scene and you know, cutie patootie Kevin Bacon.
Oh, my God.
Right?
No.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the music of Footloose, we have to acknowledge that the 80s was so rich with soundtracks, right? In a way that other eras are not. And there's a reason for that. It's because music started to be used differently in movies in the 80s. Okay, I'm going to get a little nerdy. Are you ready?
Oh,
just
so
for a
ready.
Second.
We love
okay.
it. Yeah.
A little nerdy. So in general, there are two ways that you can use songs in movies. I'm not talking about a score. I'm not talking about music. I'm talking about songs. And that is, here are my nerdy words, diegetically and non-diegetically. So diegetic. Yep. Everybody take notes. Sharpen your pencils. Diegetic, non-diegetic. Diegetic songs. That's music that exists in the world of the movie, meaning that the characters can hear it. A character may stop and break into song. The cantina, you walk into the cantina in Star Wars and the band is playing. The people in the movie can hear that music. Non-diegetic music is not part of the real world of the movie. The characters cannot hear it. Only the viewer hears it. And it's there for the viewer to understand something like about the vibe or the tone of the scene, or it's providing commentary about what's happening in the scene or about your character. Like when Rocky is running up the steps of the museum, he's gonna fly now, right? Or Rocky has the eye of the tiger. We're learning something from this song. And in the 50s and the 60s, all we had was diegetic music. We only had characters singing the song or characters dancing to a song that was being played by a band in the movie or an anthem. The only other thing would be an anthem over opening credits, but that's separate. That's a different thing. We didn't have non-diegetic music until The Graduate. Cuckoo, ca-choo, Mrs. Robinson. Mm. That's the first time we had a song where somebody wasn't singing it or listening to it. And this is why the 80s is the golden age of soundtracks, because diegetic music came of age from The Graduate, and it was peaking in the 80s. And before watching Footloose this week, I would have told you that all of the songs in Footloose were non-diegetic. As we, that's how we think of a soundtrack, right?
Just you mean, giving us good vibes. Is that the one, the first one, where they're hearing it too?
Right.
Oh, where they are hearing it too.
No, non-diegetic. They can't hear it.
Good, because I was about to say, no, they're actually listening to the same things we are.
It's very sneaky. It's very sneaky in Footloose. You think that it's just music that's playing for the viewer. Like that's how we think of soundtracks. But Footloose walked a very fine line by doing some very small but clever things to make the songs more than just background music for the viewer. They were super sneaky. So as we go through these songs, I'll let you know.
Yeah, oh, that'll be fun. You can go diegetic, non-diegetic.
I can only think of one that I would know for sure.
One thing that I thought was funny watching it again that I don't know that I noticed all the other times I've seen it. That boombox gets passed around unless they all have the same boombox.
That's right.
But
that's
someone different is always carrying that same boombox.
There's always a boombox.
Yeah, for sure. Well, in a town where dancing is illegal, these songs become the character's way of communicating. So are y'all ready?
Okay.
Yep. We're going to go song by song of this iconic soundtrack in the order they appear in the movie and discuss. Gate, the song Footloose tells you exactly what kind of movie this is going to be and what it's about without saying a word of dialogue. Some facts you might not know. Kenny Loggins wrote the 1984 hit as a favor to his friend and screenwriter, our hero. Who is
Dean
it?
Pitchford. Dean Pitchford.
Ding, 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 ding. Mm-hmm. Everybody listening, I want you to get your beverage of choice, if it's alcoholic, great, and tell us how much, either how full you are of liquid by the end or how drunk you are by drinking every time we say Dean Pitchford.
Okay, I have to add, too. Did that name sound familiar to you guys, Dean Pitchford?
A little bit. Why?
Fame.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great.
And I don't know, I didn't Google it, so I can't give you all the stats. I just know that he was involved in the music in some way. I'm going to guess he was the lyricist for Fame. So he is no stranger to the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. He's so great. Well, he needed a title song for this little movie he was writing called Footloose. And Kenny Loggins had, you know, at the time, he was still mostly known for the soft rock stylings, kind of with Jim Messina. He'd had a handful of breakout solo hits, but he had recently written I'm All Right for Caddyshack, I mean, in 1980. So, you know, that had been a few years before at the time. Let's not forget, he was probably writing this in like 1982 for this movie. And that song was a huge breakout for him and became kind of like an anthem for Caddyshack. So he was more than willing to branch out and be like, yeah, all right, another one. He says he wrote the song Footloose in one day.
Wow.
That's so Kenny Loggins. I know.
Who are these people? And there's a great behind the scenes story about the conception and the writing process of Footloose in Kenny Loggins' memoir called Still All Right. I love the title. Still All Right. But the Vulture article where I read this excerpt, the whole thing is just way too long to share right now because we have a soundtrack to get to.
Yeah.
So I will include the link in this week's Weekly Reader. It's very much worth reading and has actually made me want to now listen to his memoir. Okay, Footloose, the song, spent 3 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 from March 31st to April 14th, 1984. And this was Kenny Loggins' only chart topper. I was surprised by that.
That's his only number one?
Well, you know, this is according to like Wikipedia and places like that. So, yeah. Footloose was the first of two number one hits from the film. And Billboard ranked it at the number four song of all songs in 1984. I think that's a good place.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Considering how big the movie was and the role that the movie played in popular culture at that moment, that seems about right.
And to me, that like totally the beat of that song is like the beat of every dance I think I did in college. I mean, Andy calls it the spur dance, but it's that like kind of kick the one foot, you know?
It's Molly Ringwald. Yeah.
And I just feel like every time I hear that song, it encompasses a whole way of dance for me and all that.
It's like a hop kick.
Yeah, you know, it's the hop kick and the arms are going.
One of those 80s songs that still today's generation still knows and you know gets and it's still played and everything. Footloose, the song, was nominated for a Golden Globe as well as an Academy Award for Best Original Song at the 1985 ceremony.
Oh, wow.
And it lost to Stevie Wonder's I Just Called to Say I Love You from The Women in Red. And that is apples and oranges, I say.
Yeah, it really is.
I have a problem with that. You can't pit those two against each other. They're both such great songs. Plays three times during the movie. The first, of course, being the iconic opening. In fact, that opening is thought of as one of the most famous opening credit sequences.
Really?
It's so memorable, right?
With the shoes. Everybody's different shoes, and they're doing the heel-toe, the different socks. They got the Reeboks.
Yeah, we don't see faces. We don't know names. Mm-mm. The feet aren't all the same. Some are athletic sneakers. Some are dress shoes. Some are boots. You can tell they are the feet of old people, young people, males, females. It's everyone. And like you said, Kristen, those feet, they're tapping, stomping, sliding, kicking. And that immediately frames dancing as something that people, all people, do without thinking. Right. So before we even know anything about this movie, before we even know dancing is illegal in Beaumont, this movie is showing us that dancing, it's basically human nature. It's basically for
the toe
everyone.
Tapping and all of that.
In the video I mentioned earlier that's so great that I'm going to share in the Weekly Reader, the editor of the film, whose name is Paul Hirsch, he said they realized having the first dance number coming in at 20-ish minutes in the film, like in the movie, that was going to be a problem. So they just called in 150 dancers and came up with dances that fit that beat.
Oh, my God. You mean of the feet. You're just talking about talking about the feet.
Yeah, just the feet.
Got
like,
okay,
because otherwise, if they, like, I guess whatever opening they had planned, it wasn't dancing. And so they're like, wait, this is a movie about dancing
that
and everything,
is a problem.
So we need this.
That's really smart. I would have been like, it's time to go now.
Yeah. Well, and the energy that you get from that opening, the energy of the song and of the feet dancing immediately clues you in to that movie's what you're about to see. I mean, it's loud, it's kinetic, it's sweaty, it's emotional. And the song, right out of the gate, it's a statement. And I feel like right out of the gate, you know you're in for a fun time, like with this movie. Kenny Loggins says that when he wrote Footloose, well, he and who? Dean Pitchford. When they wrote Footloose, they'd always envision it as the barroom scene, never the opening and closing of the movie. So he goes to the movie. He writes the song. Then he leaves, The movie's being filmed.
Okay.
He goes to the screening. Kenny Loggins is sitting in the audience. And when it starts and he sees those feet and hears his song, he said he was like, what? And he was like, so pleased. And he was like, wow, this is going to be a home run because of how.
So he just thought it would be like embedded in the middle somewhere in a race. Because that bar scene is a random scene.
Which is in the second scene. Yeah. I have to ask you this before I move on. For Kristen and me, our question is back in the 80s, Carolyn, for you last week, did you have favorite feet in 1984 or back in the day? I did.
That's a good question.
That I loved every time they came up. Mine were the little, like, they're like white. They look like flat K-Swiss sneakers, kind of like canvas ones. And they have worn
little
leg warmers.
Tree torns. They're tree torns.
They were like tree torns. Yes. They were tree torns. Yeah. And then there's another pair. They were Reeboks with rainbow leg warmers.
Yeah.
And every time I watched that movie, like, those were my most pleasing feet.
I didn't at the time recognize that, but I'm going to say tree torn because obviously I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, they're like the canvas, flat, worn. I used to have tree torns too. I loved them. And That one, they're kind of, it's kind of like a beige, ratty.
Yeah, they're all of these shoes, for the most part, are well loved.
Right.
They've been, there's been a lot of dancing going on in all of these shoes.
Well, and it wasn't just the main cast. I mean, the main cast did get to dance. Mm-hmm. Kevin Bacon's feet are in there. But the production brought in various dancers. Even crew members got to provide their feet. And fun fact, if you look closely at the gold booted feet, and it's around 118, the minute 18 in, that's Kenny Loggins' boots.
Really?
Yeah.
And they're gold? I know exactly which ones you're talking about. Yeah. Okay.
He happened to be on set. So here's a question. If he didn't know, I'm just thinking this out loud now. If he didn't know that song was being used in the open, was he fibbing when he said that? His feet are in the...
Yeah, maybe they spliced that in after he was so impressed with the scene. Maybe. They said, they said, well, we'll get your feet in there too. And they put it in.
But we also know that when they record dancing scenes of any kind, they often don't use the same song.
You're right.
They might even use just a click track just to keep you on beat, but they're not using the song.
So maybe then they decided later,
He's on set. They're like, oh, here, do a little dancey thing. We're going to play an Elvis Presley song. And he's like, yay, I'm in the opening credits. Yay. Yeah.
Okay, so go and stop. Go to 1:18 and you'll see Kenny Loggins' feet. Okay, we have the second place we hear Footloose in the movie is at the bar where they intended it to be. And it just breaks in. It's not the whole song. It comes in with, now I gotta cut loose. And this is when they're at the bar and Rusty, Sarah Jessica Parker, is going nuts because she's sitting on the sidelines with Willard, who can't dance. And it's so infectious. And the way she just bobs her little head she's like, I can't help myself, Willard. And she has to just run in there and just start.
And she's just doing your dance, Carolyn. She's just teeny weeny. And she's literally bouncing in her chair, kicking her feet.
And kicking and like little, like with glee. Yeah. With glee.
And I've not even seen the movie that much. Like I bet you I've never even seen it on video. I bet I only saw it in the theater because when I saw it this time, it was kind of a deja vu experience. Oh, and yet there were elements that were so Husker Du-y, and that was one of them. The image of her bouncing, like she gotta go dance.
She has her feet flung over like a little wall and she just starts kicking them. And it's just, then she runs out there and she's dancing with anybody who'll dance with her. And it's just such a representation of just how much joy and glee dancing gives you.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think there's little pockets, and we'll talk about them as you guys start talking about songs, that the music is kind of directing us to
well, yeah, like you said earlier, it's in us. It's not this thing outside of us. Like she couldn't help, her legs.
And that's
it was an impulse.
And it's part of who we are. So imagine being told this thing that's in you can't happen.
Yeah, it's illegal. You're not allowed. No wonder they're going across the state line to go dance at a bar.
And even poor Willard is looking so longingly out there at him. He wishes so much. Yeah. And then, of course, the song plays during the epic final prom scene. And using Footloose again at the end of the movie, this time inside the story, not out at it's really a victory lap and it's a full circle moment. Kenny Loggins says that the song, when they wrote it, it was written to be inseparable from the movie so that they could make sure the audience felt that same celebratory energy at the end. That's why, you know, they ended up just putting it in other places because I think the song is truly a representation of that. Yeah. Of a celebration, right?
Like, remember at that, like, right before the song starts, he says, I thought this was a party. Let's dance! And then Footloose begins, and we get the iconic Footloose dance number with Kevin Bacon doing his little, you know, shoot your feet out thing.
Yeah, I love it!
It's so damn cute.
And I read this in something. Like I said, I was doing a lot of research, and I'm sorry I can't cite this because I think it's so great, and I wish I could take credit for writing this, but I didn't. At the beginning, Footloose is almost theoretical. It's played over anonymous feet. We don't know the story yet. It represents transformation. The movie opens with feet that want to dance. It ends with feet that are allowed to dance.
Yes.
And that difference is everything.
That's the whole theme of the movie. There you go. Uh-huh.
And I tell you guys, y'all, if you don't, in that last scene, like when he comes in, and they, if you don't get up and dance during that scene, your legs are broken. I mean, I can't even know. In my living room a couple weeks ago, I had to just get up off my sofa and dance in the... It's so fun.
And when you know, especially as an adult, when you're watching it and you can see those kids dancing and you know that the joy is tripled because they're not allowed to dance. They've previously, like, this is the, you got to cut loose, foot loose, and we can dance whenever we want. Mm-hmm. But they are cutting twice as loose because they've not been allowed to do it. And it makes that ending scene, that prom scene, all the more fun. And that was, by the way, in the prom scene, that is diegetic because they're listening to the song at the prom while they dance. It's in, they can hear it
at
just
the bar
like we
too.
Can. And at the bar, too, it's playing at the bar. They can hear the song just like we can.
Thank you, Professor.
Very nice. So coming in at number two, everybody, is the one song off of the soundtrack that never was released as a single. Oh. And this would be the song The Girl Gets Around, performed by Sammy Hagar pre-Van Halen. Okay, guys, this is when he's just kind of getting on our radar. This song is perfection for telling the story and propelling this narrative forward. Okay, this happens, literally, it's the second scene, really, in the movie. The first scene is, you know, we're in the town and we learn that it's this really buttoned up, have no fun, straight and narrow. Again, I thought it was the 1950s in the beginning of the movie. So this scene is, let me just say, I was on the edge of my seat last week.
Oh my God,
okay?
I know.
The tension around the scene is incredible.
It's so nutty.
Let me tell you what is happening in this scene. Ariel and her friends are zooming down the road when Ariel's boyfriend, and I forget his name.
Chuck.
Oh, that's right.
The bad boyfriend. The bad boyfriend, Chuck.
And Ariel's bad boyfriend pulls up behind them in his pickup truck. And we start to see that Ariel is not this goody-two-shoes buttoned-up pastor's daughter that we thought she might be. She is wild and she gets around. Okay, so here you go, guys. I'm going to try to say it as quickly as I can. But Chuck pulls up next to the car. Obviously, he's in on the wrong way of traffic. And all of a sudden, Ariel decides, huh, I think I can get out of my window, straddle the two cars, and put my hands above my head, all while Sammy Hagar, perfect song for this, is singing, Girl Gets Around. Words are playing like, well, she'd like you to think she was born yesterday with her innocent looks and her little town ways. When she's smiling at me, she's got angels in her eyes. But I've seen how she moves and the girl really cooks. And that is what she is doing in this scene. You guys, I just thought, what on earth is happening here? This like is so dangerous.
I think it's possible.
Dangerous.
Isn't it impossible, you guys?
And she's at one point, she is standing with one foot on the wheel or on the window of her friend's car and one foot on the window of the bad boyfriend's car. And she's standing while what comes at them?
A giant semi 18-wheeler coming full speed. And you guys, the trucks were real, okay? The timing was critical in this because there's no CGI back in 1983, 82, whenever we're filming this movie.
So a stunt person was really doing
that? Now, I don't know that a stunt person was, well, yeah, I think a stunt person was really doing that. Now, how fast they were going and if the truck was really as close as it was because.
But still. Yeah.
And the song,
it doesn't matter.
Sammy Hagar is screaming this song, and it seems to get louder and louder as Ariel, again, straddling the cars, and we see the semi-tractor trailer coming at them. Sarah Jessica Parker screaming, get in the car! And, I mean, Ariel's not doing anything. You think
She's
not just laughing. This is when I'm like, this is not, her hands are up, and she's dancing.
She's
swaying to the music, and I'm like,
well, poor Sarah Jessica Parker is having a coronary.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
And I was having a coronary.
I think there was maybe, you know, and this is me putting a Carolyn spin on it, and this would be later in the movie when I question whether or not she didn't have like a will to die. Like, I think
a
she
death
was
wish.
Like, a death wish. Wish. That's the term I'm
A death
I'm
wish,
trying.
Yeah. Well, let's think about that, too. And listeners, we're going to be kind of talking about the scenes as they go with the music, but It is a good question, Carolyn, because we learn a little bit later that her brother was killed in a car accident.
Yes.
Now she has all this pressure on her to be the only child, the perfect child. So it doesn't
It seems like some of those behaviors.
That she's going to do some really risky things
that she's partaking in. Yeah, is part of her kind of rebellion. And that's a part of that storyline. And it plays out in this song. And then, oh my gosh, like in real life, this couldn't have happened, the physics of it. But the semi truck is so close. And all of a sudden, you hear like the scene, the camera goes away from her. And next thing you know, she's pulled into the truck and she's sitting. Chuck pulled her in by her ankle. And she got through the window and is sitting perfectly fine.
And she's laughing. And she's laughing.
As the 18-wheeler goes whizzing by.
Oh, my God. It's bad. And it's great. The mixture of the song and the thing that is happening it's setting up the whole movie
and telling
us who Ariel is, because she's got this pastor daddy who doesn't want her to do stuff, and she's the girl who does all the stuff.
Right.
It's setting up the whole character. And as a parent, again, remember, I haven't seen it since like 1984 or something. And as I'm watching it as a parent this time, I'm super angry with her. I'm so mad at her.
Yeah.
She endangered all of those people, not just herself.
Right. And you know what? To your point, Kristen, I hadn't really put two and two together, but I never really liked her character in this movie.
I didn't either.
I think that's what set it up. So from the get-go, we're like, you would do that to all those people, your friends, and, you know, this innocent 18-wheeler truck driver that's coming down the road. Like, who do you think you are? And I think that kind of clouded my judgment about her the whole movie.
And well, I didn't know that until it's very selfish. And I didn't put that together, what you just said. I didn't put that together until this watching of it. I've never liked her. I didn't like her the first time I saw it. And so I never thought that their relationship was believable, because I'm like, why would you be with a bully like her? And this time I'm like, this is why, because the first scene that we meet her and they're telling us about her, she has complete and utter disregard for the safety of all of those people. They all could have been killed. And her friends are pleading with her. Her friend driving the car, they're like, Ariel, get in the car. And poor Sarah Jessica Parker. I'm just feeling so bad for all of them.
Yeah.
And I'm angry with her. I'm so angry.
To play devil's advocate and to take a card from Carolyn's playbook and Pretty in Pink, I think we can maybe understand her a little bit better if you think about everything we just said and how she's the pressure that she has from this this family and we get to see a lot more of that, the relationship between her and her father, and how much she wants out of the relationship with her father she's not getting from him until maybe the very end. But I still am right with you guys. I think it's extremely selfish, and she has such disregard, and I don't like her in that moment at all. And for much of it, but then you see that, you know, we're going to keep seeing, I mean, we could do a whole entire podcast episode just on Ariel, right? Because then you see the way she's been allowing herself to get treated by her boyfriend. I mean, he's physically abusive to her. I'm not just verbally abusive. And so we can go down, you know, we can therapize Ariel for 2 hours.
Well, and if you think about the, you know, all the things that you said about her family pressure, and it's not just her family, because her dad is really the dad of the whole town.
He's
the preacher for the whole town. And so he's not just telling Ariel not to do all of these things and to be a good girl. He's telling the whole town not to do those things.
Yeah.
And so it's like her job to make sure that she's not associated with him. And somebody in the movie at some point says, when they're talking about her behavior, and this person, I wish I could remember what character it was, says, she's just going to do everything she can to make you forget that she's the preacher's daughter. And that's exactly what she's doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, she'd like you to think she was born yesterday with her innocent looks and a little town
way. When she smiles at me, she got angels in her eyes. Okay, so next we have Dancing in the Sheets. I love this song. This is by Shalimar, which is the band that gave us Jody Watley, by the way. I'm looking for a new love, baby. Jody Watley didn't actually sing this song, but I don't care, because that's a really fun fact. Jody Watley was the best new artist of 1987. And totally unrelated to Footloose, this is for Carolyn. Jody Watley was married to Andre Simone. Andre Simone. Okay, they know their looks on their faces are not giving me a positive. Okay, let me just explain. Andre Simone. So when Prince got kicked out of the house at age 13, he went to live with Andre Simone and his family. Andre Simone was a schoolmate of his. And he's like, can I live at your house, Andre? And so he went and he moved in with Andre Simone. Andre Simone then went on to have his own. He was in various iterations of Prince's band. He had his own solo career. And apparently he was married to Jody Watley.
That's crazy.
So if you didn't go deep on funk music in the 80s, maybe you don't know that name. But just know, he was Prince's buddy, and he lived with him when he was 13. Okay, so when I read, I love this song, and when I read the lyrics, you know, you sing along, but I, like, looked up the lyrics, and I read this one line, and I got, Hoosker Dude, because there's a line that says, grab your coat and wave goodbye to your friends. And I remembered that my friends and I had this little move that we would do. Of course we did. We would do the moonwalk, and then we would be like, wave goodbye to your friends. Pretend they're doing the moonwalk. We're like, grab your coat and wave goodbye to your friends. Wave goodbye. And we thought we were so cool because we could moonwalk. Okay, so this song is a play on the hit, on the Motown hit, Dancing in the Street. It's a play on words. And it's played in the scene a la Grease with like milkshakes and burgers and hot dogs and, you know, high school hijinks in the parking lot. Ariel's friends arrive in their car and they are pissed because their friend almost killed them. And Ariel arrives in her bad boyfriend's truck, which is tricked out to tell the audience that he is a redneck. Like they are over the top trying to show you who he is. There are antlers on the car. There's antlers, a gun rack. And he is the, and so this is done to show us that he is the antithesis of our city boy, Ren. Yeah. So these two are going to be enemies. Mm-hmm. And also notably in his car is a boombox. There's a boombox. Mm-hmm. I guess he doesn't have a stereo in his car. And so he just has like the boombox propped up in the back window. And when they arrive at the drive-in, Ariel grabs the boombox and puts it on the hood of the car. This is what will make this song diegetic.
Yeah.
Because it's actually going to happen in the scene, in the world of the characters, and they will hear it. So then she grabs something out of her pocket, and bad boyfriend says the words, smuggled tapes. Smuggled tapes. And they behold the smuggled tape like she's a kid in seventh grade showing you a joint for the first time, basically. She pops it in the boombox and presses play, and we hear the opening to Dancing in the Sheets. And all the high school hijinks are now being done on the beat.
It's the beat of Dancing in the Sheets.
They chew their gum to the beat. They eat their hot dog to the beat. They talk on the payphone to the beat. And the beat is infectious. And pretty soon everyone, they can't hold still. They can't control themselves. And they have to dance. And that, of course, is illegal. It's so adolescent. Like the whole song, the whole notion of the song is very adolescent. It's so cheeky because you're at this age when you're starting to think about dancing in the sheets, even if you aren't dancing in the sheets, but you're like, hee, hee, hee. And just when it's about to turn into a full-on dance party, the music abruptly stops.
Dun,
because
dun, dun.
Ariel's pastor daddy has arrived and he presses the stop button and Ariel is in trouble. And as a viewer, you're like, oh, shit. And she looks guilty, guilty, guilty. Like she's a seventh grader. Again, like with a joint instead of a boombox, instead of a cassette tape, right? But Daddy Pastor instead very quietly says, your mother didn't think that you had any money with you. And then he like stuffs some crumpled bills into her hand and he turns around and he leaves all Charlie Brown like, which is worse than getting in trouble.
Right. I was going to say, that's worse. Like the epitome of, I'm not mad at you. I'm disappointed.
I'm just disappointed. That's exactly what this is. And Ariel feels shame, so much shame. He is shaming her by being disappointed and bereft instead of angry. And that's so much worse. So Dean Pitchford, drink, everybody drink. Dean Pitchford. He says he knew that he needed the lyrics to be naughty enough for Daddy Pastor to object to it. But if he did this play on Dancing in the Streets, it was not overtly naughty. It was more like wink, wink. And he said it needed to be suggestive enough that it would provoke her father's ire, but not vulgar in an over-the-top kind of way. Mission accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
Mission accomplished. Plus, the song is literally about dancing. In the streets or otherwise, in the sheets, whatever. And so even if you didn't get the wink, wink part, you could get in trouble just for listening to a song about the thing you're not allowed to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. again, I've been seeing this movie and these songs in such a different way now because of something you said in the beginning, Michelle. It is innate in us to move to music when we hear the song and the beat. And like you're saying, Kristen, they're chewing. They're, everything mm-hmm. they're doing is to that beat because that's mm-hmm. how our bodies respond. And so to be told, again, the theme of this movie is being told over and over that you can't do this thing that your body is automatically doing. And yeah. you're being told, you know, no, it's illegal.
It's Yikes. Just oppression. It's oppression and restriction yep. and suppression. And it makes people, what we found out, makes people mean. Mm-hmm. Makes people mean and nasty. Mm-hmm.
I love that song so much. That's probably too. My number two. That's hard. It's hard to rank the songs. I have definite number one.
But your friend.
I promise right. you that every time I hear that now, I'm going to, in my mind at least, I'm going to be moonwalking and waving.
Right. Well, we're going to move on to our next song, which, you guys, it's called Somebody's Eyes. And of course, having not seen this movie and not recognizing the song, I was like, where is it in the movie? But because I tried to do all this research and I found some interesting things. There is just one line of this song played in the movie. This is the song when they're at the picnic, but it only plays. There's only a little music that plays and it's almost at the end of the scene. So you hear there's obviously an instrumental in the beginning of the song. And then there's like the first line and that is all. Wow, that is all that you hear of the song.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. Now this was written all by Dan Pickford. Okay.
Dean Pickford. But thanks for making up his name.
Dan Pickford. It kept correcting in my thing because it kept changing it to Pitchfork every time I typed it. And so I think this one, it changed it. Okay. Dan Pickford.
No,
okay.
Dean Pickford.
Who's Dan?
Oh, no.
Dean. Okay, so it's Dean Pickford, right?
There we go.
Yeah. Okay. I've got it so wrong. I'm going to go look up Dan Pickford when I'm done. He's probably someone really famous.
Mary okay. Pickford's husband.
So, mm-hmm. interestingly enough, this song was written entirely by Dan.
No. it wasn't.
Dan. Okay. The song was written by Dean Pickford, everybody.
Okay, good.
You listen to all of the lyrics, which you will never hear in the movie. It pretty much tells the story about this town, like a small town. Somebody's always watching you. Somebody's eyes are on you.
Ooh, ouch.
Okay. Are you guys ready for this? Originally, yeah. in the original filming of the movie, this song was actually played and the entire song was played. They had it during the montage of Christopher Penn trying to learn to dance.
No,
that's no, right. Yeah.
No. Absolutely not. That does not work
at all.
It's like such a pretty song.
Somebody's yeah. eyes but if you looking. Catch, if you listen to the beat is exactly like the beat in Let's Hear It for the Boy and put them together because, like you said earlier, Kristen, sometimes they film a dance scene to one song mm-hmm. and then yeah. they put another song in. So when they realized that Somebody's Eyes was not going to work for this montage dance scene where he's learning how to dance, they had to quickly come up and write another song mm-hmm. that would be that would fit better into that scene. And then okay. I'm sure we'll hear more about that when we talk about that song, Let's Hear It for the Boy. So the song was already written. It was already performed, all of that. So they sneak it in with this little snippet of it during the picnic scene of Chuck and Don. God bless America. Okay. Of Chuck and Ariel at this little picnic, which really, I don't even know why that scene is in the movie at all.
I do. It's very, that's where she's got her red boots and she says, my daddy hates these boots. And
well, that's true.
She's feeling all like empowered kind of in her boots that daddy hates and whatever. And then Chuck says to her, she says, I'm getting out of here.
Well,
she tells him,
yeah. I'm going to college.
Like next year I'm going to college. And he says, why? You're not going. And he goes, you're a small town as they come. Oh, and God. She just turns away from him. Like mm-hmm. that's the last thing she wants to hear.
Right.
I think
she's
it's
trying
a good
to
scene to
right.
Really illustrate who she is
yeah.
and where mm-hmm. she's coming from more. And maybe for us to get a little bit more sympathy toward her. I don't
right.
know.
I mean, because mm-hmm. I think it comes very soon after, obviously, our other scene where we have the girl gets whatever she gets. Wild.
Around.
Around.
She gets around.
Mm-hmm. I was like, what does she get? Like chicken pox?
Around. She gets
gonorrhea?
Around.
She yes. gets shingles.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so that's where somebody's eyes comes okay. in. That mm-hmm. scene, but literally like 4 or 5 seconds up.
And I can't even picture the scene. This is such a nothing burger.
Somebody's eyes are watching. Somebody's eyes are seeing me loving.
This next song, I there's a little confusion with this next song, but all you need to know really is that I love this song. Holding Out for a Hero was the next one, sung by Bonnie Tyler of Total Eclipse of the Heart fame. But she said she would only do it if she could work with songwriter Jim Steinman. This is a name people might know. Jim Steinman is known for his very, like, outlandishly intense anthems like Paradise by the Dashboard Light and Bat Out of Hell. He did tons of Meatloaf stuff. And, of course, Total Eclipse of the Heart, like things that are just like melancholy and anthemic, and there's just so much drama in
Big anthems too,
they're
right?
Huge yeah. anthems. And Holding Out for a Hero follows suit. This is a big anthem. It's so intense, it's so overly dramatic, and so earnestly invested that it's actually mocked by a lot of people who just can't take it. It's too much. A lot of people hate this song because it's too dramatic. And our theme, the theme of this scene that it's happening in, can be found in the first lines of the song. Where have all the good guys gone, and where are all the gods?
Yeah.
Where's the streetwise Hercules who fight the rising odds? That's essentially yeah. what's happening here in this scene. So Jim Steinman literally bled for this song when he demoed it for Dean Pitchford. Drink. So, you know, the beginning of the song is like, dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, love
and
it.
Dean Pitchford says he was just pounding the shit out of the keyboard. Everyone was just grooving along, and he's pounding, pounding, and the girls are singing, singing, singing. And at the end of the whole thing, I looked over, and there was blood up and down the keyboard.
Oh!
So when he writes a dramatic song, he is not half-assing it.
He is in it, for
he
sure.
He is yeah. in it. And that kind of intensity really matches the scene perfectly.
Yeah.
Just prior to this scene, Ariel had shown up at Ren's. He's got like a flour sack job. He like carries flour sacks.
Is I think it's like grain. It's like he okay, works at a grain you. Elevator.
I was at first I was like, what is this place? He's just like picking up sacks of flour.
So yeah, greenery. Oklahoma, but Utah in the movie.
Yeah.
But
yeah, there we
very,
go.
Very fits in with the Oklahoma original.
So he's at his flour sack job. And and she gives him, Ariel comes by, and she gives him this very ominous sort of she-bully message. There's another reason I don't like her. She's a bully. She says, I have a message from Chuck. That's bad boyfriend. He says, meet him at the edge of his daddy's field. And Ren says, why? She says, you'll find out. And then she turns around and leaves. Okay, so Ren shows up at the edge of his daddy's field, and now what we find out is that Ren has to learn how to drive a tractor because chicken races.
Tractor chicken.
Tractor mm-hmm. chicken. Ariel's bad boyfriend plans to humiliate the big city kid by beating him at a game of tractor chicken. And there's no way that the kid from Chicago knows how to drive a tractor. But the guy who sends his girlfriend to tell you to meet him at the edge of his daddy's field probably does. And that is not fair. That's not fair. So the question is, will Ren prove himself? Ren is very, oh my God, how did I get myself in this? He asks Willard, he's like, has anyone ever died doing this? And Willard says, just once, just yeah. once. And again, somebody pulls out a boombox, again with the boombox, and presses play so that we have musical accompaniment to our mm-hmm. chicken races. That makes this song diegetic. I don't know how they could hear the song over the sound
well,
of the tractors.
In most of the scenes where this the diegetic
yeah.
song,
yeah.
you have to wonder that. But
yeah.
you also have to just suspend reality for a little
you
bit.
You have to.
Because it's a movie.
It's a
yeah.
movie. Right.
It's I almost love, a clever really trick.
I love that part, though, that you just described when Ren first gets on the tractor. He's like, how do yeah. I? And he's getting advice from everybody,
right.
from Willard, from Woody, the other character who he's befriended. And
yeah.
they're all telling him, and then, and don't press this, and whatever you do, don't touch this, and don't.
Right.
And I just got so nervous again watching it. And I yes. know how it ends.
And yeah. he's clearly nervous. Ren does not know what he's doing. He's looking down. He's pulling at levers. He's struggling to hold on to the steering wheel. And he accidentally raises the bucket on the front of the tractor. But then that looks like a challenge. So then Chuck raises his bucket too. And Ren's like, oopsie. Like, I didn't mean to do that. I just pressed a button. Ren is sweating. He's wiping his brow. He is scared. And at a certain point, he's like, I am out. Fuck this shit. I do not need to prove myself in this way. Why am I doing this? And he tries to jump off. Repeatedly, he tries to jump off, but his shoelace is stuck on the pedal. And somebody wrote this in a comment, and it was so brilliant. Essentially, he can't get his foot loose. Yep. Can't get his foot loose. His shoelace is stuck on the pedal, and he cannot jump ship. But guess who does? Chuck is the one who chickens out, and he jumps off the tractor. The tractor goes tumbling into the water. Again, somebody could have been killed.
His tractor's just like him.
Right. It does. How does it not fall on him? None of this makes sense. And Ren is the winner, even though it's by accident. But he has successfully faced down the bully and gained everyone's respect. But he's the hero, holding out for a hero. Where have all the good guys gone? He's the good guy. And he becomes the hero not by being a badass, but by being scared and vulnerable and doing it anyway. It's such a good song for the intensity of this scene. I mean, they almost died. This song is just like dun 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 dun. And it is a companion. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's so perfect when she says, white knight upon a fiery steed. It's like they're doing the shots of them both on the tractor.
Yes, it's on the steed. Perfectly, on the fiery steed.
It's perfectly done.
I've got a John Deere and you've got an Alice Chalmers. I think that's a tractor, or maybe it's an actress. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's a really great companion to the scene in Greece where Danny wins the drag race at Thunder Road.
Totally.
And all the kids like, yay! And they remember how they just all come running at Danny and they just all run and throw their arms around him. And that's exactly what happens to Ren. He wins the race. The kids are ecstatic and they all run toward his tractor. And he's the big hero. And there are kids just jumping all over him. He's he's the white knight on the steed.
Well, I had read, too, that they showed that scene to Bonnie Tyler before she performed the song.
Really?
Because they wanted her to kind of get that feel that we got from the song of what's happening and, you know, this chicken fight thing we're seeing with the tractors. And so you hear that in her actual performance of the song, too. So
the urgency. Yeah.
Exactly.
The urgency.
Exactly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Late at night.
The next song is Never, and the scene that accompanies this song is widely recognized as one of the most memorable moments in the movie, and it is a masterpiece in teen angst. Right? First, let's get our drinking out of the way. Never was written by Dean Pitchford. Drink. And everybody remember him? And Michael Gore. And it was recorded by the Australian pop rock band Moving Pictures.
Okay, I just have to jump in. Michael Gore wrote the music for Fame.
It's all intertwined.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah. It's all coming back to me now, which is a song written by Jim Steinman.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think this is kind of sad, this little fact. Despite the popularity of this song, Moving Pictures were never paid royalties from its use.
Yeah. What awful is that?
They said, we performed it. It was written by the guys who made the movie, and we got nothing from it. Someone made a lot of money out of that song, and it wasn't us.
What kind of contract do you have that doesn't pay you for that?
I know. So then they say in this little interview I read, they're like, so subsequently in all of our shows, we're never, 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 ever, ever going to sing that song again. Let's think about the scene that this song is used in. It's when Ren is dancing in the warehouse. And when he's dancing to this song, again, he pushes play, like he plays it on his little, in his, the stereo of his little VW Bug. Yep. But yet he's dancing all over the warehouse. Yep. So it must have some great speakers, right? But he's basically shouting his frustration and his anger. in this new world he's living in that's silencing him. The song is almost like his internal dialogue. So to remind you of what instigates this anger, by this point in the movie, we're 35 minutes into the movie, Ren is beyond overwhelmed and frustrated by the strict and religious, illogical restrictions against dancing in this little, you know, backwards town he's moved into. And then, just to top it off, his close-minded uncle, he gets in an argument with him, and he pounds the final nail into this coffin, I think, that Ren is feeling trapped in, when he scolds him, and then he offhandedly says, "You know that I would never try to take the place of your father." When the uncle says that to him, he slams out and he races his little yellow VW bug to the empty warehouse. And as he pulls it in, I swear that little VW bug has angry headlight eyes because the song is starting. Yes. Mm-hmm. And you see this cute little bug pull in, and all I can imagine is the eyes, like in the movie Cars.
Like,
you know, the eyes have,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the synthesized staccato begins. And Ren, he grabs a beer. And oh, that's rebellious too, right?
Creepy.
He grabs a beer. And we see all that is going on in his mind via flashes of all these moments we've already seen in the movie that have led to this anger and frustration. It's Ariel dismissing him. It's that asshole bully Chuck Cranston. It's the bully cop. It's Reverend Moore pounding the pulpit in church, you know, mm-hmm. which seems very, like you said, Carolyn, very like 1950s mm-hmm. to him, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just all too much. The boy needs to dance is what he needs to do. And they call it, in everything I read, they call this dance punch rage. And I'll be honest, y'all, I really wish I could do some punch rage dancing right now. I might just need to install like a high bar in my backyard.
a pommel horse.
A little bit, and as the lyrics say, well, you're hot. Lyrics are just like, they're written to just narrate these scenes. The lyrics then go on to speak to fighting through pain and breaking free. They says it's time to fight, time for tearing free, which directly mirrors Ren's situation since getting to this backwards town of Beaumont. And the scene and this song together, like the combination of them, they show Ren as not just a rebellious kid, because he's really not. If we think about
he's just a normal teenager.
He's just someone who's deeply affected by just the stifling rules and atmosphere of
and the
this
meanies.
Town.
Like, so many people are just mean to him. They're picking on him.
They're picking and at him, really. And anyway, it allows us to really see, I don't know, his vulnerability and his internal self a lot. It's widely recognized, like I said before, this scene is widely recognized as one of the most memorable moments in the film.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just this emotional release. And like I said, this punch rage. Mm-hmm. I have a fun fact for you.
Okay.
It was Kevin Beck. He wanted to do all the dancing. And they were like, dude, you can dance. We know you're a gymnast and you can dance. You can't do it all. So they brought in a guy named Peter Tram, who was the main dance double. But guess who was the gymnastic double?
Burt Connor.
Good guess.
It's the only name I know.
It's someone named Chuck Gaylord.
Mitch Gaylord.
Mitch Gaylord. Oh, my God.
Mitch Gaylord's older brother.
Oh, my God.
Yep. Now, everybody listening, if you're like, Mitch Gaylord, that sounds familiar. 84 Olympics.
Yes, he was
medalist.
That was my guy.
Oh, yeah. I had a poster of him.
Oh, I did, too.
Was he a cutie.
He was a cutie.
And Chuck, his older brother, wasn't an Olympic medalist, but he was an 11-time All-American gymnast.
Wow.
So
wow.
If you go back and watch the, you know, some of the gymnastics, that's
it's really the biggest dance number in the movie.
Yeah.
I think it's the most impactful dance number in the movie. It's one of the most impactful moments in the movie. And this is so funny. And I wonder if some other people listening right now are going to be with me on this. But when I chose the song Holding Out for a Hero, I thought it was this scene. I thought it was the punch you? Rage dancing scene. And so then I asked Liam, because Liam has opinions about Footloose. And so I'm like, Liam, what is your favorite song from Footloose? What is your favorite scene? He's like, well, obviously it's Holding Out for a Hero. And, you know, when he's dancing on the pommel horse and doing the gymnastics. I'm like, dude, no, that's not Holding Out for a Hero. He's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So I'm not the only one. There have got to be other people who thought Holding Out for a Hero is when he's dancing in the warehouse.
I would say just from the research I did, if you take that little that little slice of population who mm-hmm. likes to comment on Reddit threads and stuff, it's about 95% of the other people think it's that song.
Really? Yeah. Okay, that makes me feel uh-huh. so much better. That
well,
makes me
feel so much better. I wonder, too, what – I don't remember the music videos for any of these, but I know that some of the music – maybe it was for Footloose, the
it's
song.
It's in Footloose. You see a lot of his warehouse
okay,
dancing.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
His rage dancing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So
and
okay.
It was fun. It was fun to be watching this scene and point out, like, okay, this is Kevin Bacon, body double. Kevin Bacon, body double. Kevin Bacon, and he's got like the little wife beater tank top on, and he's got his skinny little jeans on, and he's doing his little flippies and his mm-hmm. pommel horse, and then he does like these little punchy, punchy, punchy.
A lot
punchy.
Of it is, and a lot of it is. It was easy for them to use. Like I said, it was Kevin Bacon plus three either dance or gymnast okay. doubles, and it was easy for them to do because so much of that scene is done in silhouette because
yes,
of the lighting
dark.
In it. And
it's
so
dark.
I love it.
Yeah.
It's
very
such
clever.
A great scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is my very favorite song on the soundtrack, then and now. And that's Let's Hear It for the Boy.
Boom. Let's hear it for the boy.
Well, Steve Morse of the Boston Globe called this song one of the happiest, most infectious sing-alongs in a long time. And I do not disagree with you, Steve
I totally
Morse.
Agree.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So good.
Yeah.
Written by Dean Pitchford, drink, and Tom Snow, like I said earlier, and performed by Denise Williams. So cute. The song topped Billboard's dance and R&B charts, and it peaked at number 2 on the UK singles chart, right behind Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go by Wham.
Wow.
Another one of my very favorite 80s songs.
They're both bops. Like, they are kind of
so
companions.
Well,
they're total companions.
The 80s had just such great bop songs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Walking totally. On Sunshine.
Yeah.
And it was also nominated with Footloose for an Academy Award for Best Original Song at the 57th Academy Awards.
Wow.
Like I said, losing to I Just Called to Say I Love You, Apples and Oranges. You can't put these two bops up against that song. Not only is it my favorite song on the soundtrack, it's my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah.
I love it so much. So this is when Ren, Willard, and Woody are in the locker room before it starts. And they're and you guys, Woody, let's just talk about the character Woody for a
I've
hot second.
I've never appreciated Woody before.
Okay,
love Woody.
He's played by an actor named John Laughlin, and he has 25 film credits, 30 TV credits. You might know him. The other only thing that I looked at his filmography, and he's an Officer and a Gentleman. He's a character named Troy.
Okay.
I confuse him with Meat from Porky's.
Oh.
He looks similar. Nope, that was a guy named Tony Ganios. But when Brian and I were watching it, I was like, is that the guy that was Meat in Porky's?
Woody is notable because he's nice. And there
he's
are no,
a nice guy.
There are no, besides Willard, there are no nice boys in this movie. They're all dicks.
Yeah.
They're bullies. Mm-hmm. They're so mean. And then,
well, none that have
thank
speaking
God for
parts.
Woody.
We see a lot of them. But anyway, so they're in the
that's
locker
true.
Room.
I don't know them. I don't know those kids.
You can't speak to them.
Right.
They're in the locker room. They're ribbing each other about Woody and Willard both not knowing how to dance. And Ren says, hey, if I got to get up in front of that town council, you got to learn to dance. Cue the 80s synthesizer and drum beats. And Ren is such a patient dance teacher.
Yes, he's
They're
so
They're sitting
kind.
In his little bug, and he's patiently trying to teach Willard to keep the beat. That's all. Just keep the beat by snapping first, then clapping, then trying to clap his hand against Willard's, then pound on the dashboard. And it's just so classic because Willard is just off the beat. He's on the off beat
and
every single time.
So hard. Is it?
Right. Oh, he's so trying so hard. And then one of my favorite parts, they're walking, but in the school, like the locker halls, but they're connected via Walkman, like headphone cord.
Oh, yeah.
Like they each, like, and they're going up and down to the beat, and you just see Ren come in first. Dun, 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 and he's doing it. But then here comes Willard, and he's offbeat.
He's off-beat, completely opposite off-beat from Kevin Bacon.
And yeah. So the whole trajectory of these dance lessons, which probably lasted over a week or two, you know, we're seeing snippets of them. And finally, finally he gets it. And they're running and they're rolling and they're doing. One of my other favorite parts is when they're on the football field and they're running, but then they yes. stop and they do that box step
they do
where
a little
they cross
jazz
over
square.
Back.
Yes.
A little jazz square. And then they're wrestling in the gym and then they're spinning the cutie nieces. And it's all so great, especially when Willard incorporates the robot.
These Willard dance moves, these are iconic. These every shape that he makes with his body is something that is seared in all of our brains.
When he finally gets it, you want to just stand up and cheer with them. Mm-hmm. And fun fact, another fun fact, this scene was put in its entirety because they shot all those things thinking they were just going to do snippets of it.
Yeah.
But they put it in its entirety. You hear the whole song in this movie. I mean, this is like a 3.5 minute scene or a 3 minute scene. And it was put in because Chris Penn actually did not know how to dance. So this was all real life. Kevin Bacon was teaching him to dance, and he would teach him to dance between takes, like off camera as well. And Chris Penn was a wrestler. So the choreographer would tell Chris Penn to relate dance moves to wrestling moves. And that's what drove this whole montage. And then I have another really good fact for you guys.
I can hardly stand it.
Listeners, I told Carolyn and Kristen to watch the video for Let's Hear It for the Boy. I hope they followed that homework direction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But it was last week, so I
okay,
I
it's
remember.
Fine. No, it's fine. Okay. It was directed by Kenny Ortega. That's not the fun fact.
but that is a good fact.
I'm going to blow your mind. So in the video, and if you remember it, there's a little boy and he's sitting in a classroom and he's so cute. And he has like a big dunce hat on at one point. Mm-hmm. And then he's in a tuxedo and Denise Williams is dancing with him and everything. The whole video is basically just him and Denise Williams. It's not anything really from the movie. So this little boy is named Aaron Lohr, L-O-H-R. And he went on to do many episodes of Sister, Sister. He was in Newsy Disney's movies. He was in the Mighty Ducks. He starred as Mickey Dolenz in the VH1 movie Daydream Believer.
What?
Those are great facts, but that's not the one I want to tell you. Guess who he's married to now?
The married thing just gets me. Okay. Oh,
the married since 2017. He's married to Idina Menzel.
What?
Yes.
Let it go.
No way.
How old is she? She was
married to Taye Diggs first. She was married to Taye Diggs, and they have a little boy together. And then they were divorced. She got married to Aaron Lohr in 2017. And if you go look at their Instagram, you can see that little boy in him.
Wow. Okay, did you notice also on the piano, the photos on the piano?
Oh no. What are those?
So it goes really fast.
Probably.
And I know that they're all significant, but I could only pick out one. It's the Hardy Boys. It's Sean Cassidy and Parker Stevenson are in a photo on the piano.
What?
Okay,
I know.
We gotta think this through then. We gotta make this make sense.
Yeah.
It has I feel to like be. I need to set up like a homeland thing on my wall with yarn and photos and yarn string so I can figure out how we connect this.
I thought that was going to be your fun fact. Mm. I thought you'd be like, did you see the photo on the piano of the Hardy
Boys?
That's
a good question.
I think that's
a
better fact than that he's married, that the little boy's now married to Idina Menzel. That blew my mind though.
I know.
Okay,
that is
well,
crazy.
You know what? Let's DM Sean. Let's ask him. Maybe he knows what. It's got to just be one of the happiest, most joyful, cutest, funnest scenes.
So cute. Yeah.
In like a lot of I want to say movie history, but
we can
everyone's
going
to come
at
me.
It.
But I do. I love that scene so much.
Yeah.
I could watch it over and over
again. I mean, just him doing the snapping of the fingers and the going up and down.
There's something to be said for a really good montage that's coupled with a really good song.
Yes.
Like, it's just a moment.
Yes.
It's really so good.
And we love Willard and we love Kevin Bacon and they're not just being the tough guys.
And we love their friendship.
We love their friendship.
The way that Ren is just cheering for him and, I mean, let's hear it for the boy, right?
Yes, let's
give
hear
the boy
it for the
a
boy.
Hand.
Oh, yeah. He's so sweet.
'Cause every time he pulls me near, let's give the boy a hand.
Okay, we're heading toward the end of the movie now, and I have a new favorite song from this movie. I thought it was one thing. Turns out it wasn't. Turns out that my new favorite movie, or my new favorite song from this movie, is I'm Free. And this is by Kenny Loggins, and I believe this is the true climax of the movie. Not the prom that we all remember. Everyone wants you to think that that is the climax of the movie. No, that's the resolution, the catharsis.
Yeah.
Because this scene with I'm Free, with Kenny Loggins, this is the scene where Ren has won. The kids have won. The battle between the teens and the preachers has been won, and they are going to have a dance. This is a this is one of the only non-diegetic songs, even though I thought they were all non-diegetic, but they're not because of that damn cassette player.
Yeah.
So this is non-diegetic, and it begins, and it takes place actually over several scenes. So they pack a lot into this song, and it is triumphant. Like I said, the kids have won, but it's not a hostile takeover. In the previous scene, Ren has visited the good reverend, the preacher, Daddy Preacher Man, and explained that they both have loss. They have a common wound. Ren's father ditched him. Pastor Daddy's son was tragically killed. Ren deals with his loss by dancing. Pastor Daddy deals with his loss by being a dick. So you tell me, which way is better? Which one is the true evil, right? Is dancing the true evil, or is being a dick the true evil? So Ren says, you know what? If you can explain to me about my father, maybe I can explain to you about your son. And a meeting of the minds has been made. And Pastor Daddy is like ruminating and thinking. And in Pastor Daddy's next sermon, he brings up the controversy of the senior prom because the kids want to change the law. Why is dancing against the law? We have to have a prom. We're teenagers. We're seniors in high school. We deserve this. And Pastor Daddy announces to the congregation that maybe we don't need to change the law, but they could be a little nicer to the kids. And that also, Ren's boss at the flower sack place has said, you can use my flower sack place as a place to have a dance.
Maybe they're milling and flour. We don't know.
It's a mill. It's a mill. Yep, it's a mill. They're milling wheat is what flour comes from. Okay. And because notably, this, I was going to say flower sack place, the mill is across the town line. They don't have to change their laws. They can have a dance at the mill. And as the pastor quietly reveals his approval of the dance in church, the song starts to play low and slow. I'm free. Hey, kids, you have been set free. You're going to have a dance. And the camera pans around the room. I'm getting nipple lightning right now. The camera pans around the room to each kid, Ren, Ariel, Rusty, Willard, Woody, the other ones, the people who don't know their names, and they realize
like
they've
Wendy
won.
Sue or Wendy Joe or something.
Yes, Wendy Joe Sperber. The song, four people are going to know
who
that is.
It's not her, by the way. We know who she is, but it's not her. If everybody right now is going, God, Kristen, it's not. We know it's not her. It was a good reference.
She doesn't know her bosom buddies. So the song very urgently but quietly transitions the viewer from the quiet of the sermon to the silent jubilation of the kids in the congregation. And as the song intensifies, the scene changes from the sanctuary of the church to three motorcycles riding abreast. It's so dramatic. It's so dramatic. And little by little, more motorcycles join the badass three motorcycles, and they start a little parade. Then the road is filled with motorcycles. I don't know why all these kids have motorcycles. It's
aren't
as if
like
everyone
mopeds?
In the town.
Aren't they like mopeds?
Yeah, mopeds, motorcycles, two wheels with a motor. Yeah. Oh, it is? Whatever. Yeah. It's a motor, and it's got two wheels. And there are a lot of them, and every kid has one. And they're driving out to the mill to decorate for the senior prom. They're gonna be free. And it's like, this is diegetic commentary, right? They're telling us that decorating for the forbidden dance has freed them to be real teenagers. They're hanging lights and stars, and this brings everyone together as a senior class. And it ends, the song ends with Ariel modeling her prom dress. They are on their way to the dance. And what makes this a Gen X movie instead of a current day movie is that the kids are doing this all on their own. There are no parents helping. And in a movie today, it would be like, the parents are going to surprise the kids by transforming exactly. the mill.
That's right. Nope. Rusty's dad's an electrician, so he's going to be yes. able to come in and do the lights.
There, it's like, we don't need you. We can do this by ourselves.
And that's what we did. I mean, now I'm remembering, like, during the day, it was like, go decorate for prom and then go home and get ready for prom. It was like you or the day
before.
Like
you were going to the prom.
Yeah. But you were also part of... Like you said, like decorating and hanging the stuff, and it wasn't, parents surprising us, or we did all the work.
Right, we did all the work, and that's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Well, you guys, we get to go to the prom, and this is exciting. We see Kevin Bacon pick up. Well, I shouldn't call him. We see Ren pick up Ariel at her home. And again, much unlike any prom we've ever experienced of the last, whatever, 10 years, he doesn't even go in the house. He just, walks out. There's no pictures. There's nothing like that. Mm-mm. But she, as goofy as she looks with her hair and all that, she's so happy. It's like
she's
it's
softer, the first she's softer. Time. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. You kind of almost see this weight lifted and that she's like... her age and she's who she's meant to be. And you get what some might think is the ultimate song of this movie. And again, I didn't know it was from this movie. We have Almost Paradise, Knocking on Heaven's Door, written by Dean Pitchford and...
Drink.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And you guys, Eric Carmen. Eric Carmen and Dean Pitchford sang this song.
That's a great duo,
Wrote this song together.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Eric Carmen is everywhere.
He is everywhere.
Yeah.
He's. We almost probably need to do a little episode on Eric Carmen. I think he's places we didn't even know he was.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. And that's right. Mm-hmm. And Sean had some very nice things to say about him. So they both wrote the song, and we have Hart's Ann Wilson and Loverboy's Mike Reno singing the classic ultimate duet.
All my life I only needed you. Oh, almost paradise. When I get on heaven's
door. Oh my gosh, their rock kind of strong voices mixed with how soft and beautiful this song is. And I read something that said this was kind of Ann Wilson's, the transition that she helped Hart make from the 70s, the real Barracuda, the kind of loud rock songs, to a little bit more of the softer 80s side that Hart became afterwards. And so
they had their 80s, they had their 80s era, just like Hall & Oates had their 80s era, and it was so different from their 70s era.
Yeah, for a lot of people, this is a quintessential prom song. I mean, this for me, it is one of the quintessential slow dance songs at these all school parties that we would have. So great classic song, a great scene. They're just finally getting to be kids in a way, like they're getting
teenagers.
To be who they're meant to be. Yeah.
The best part is how nobody's dancing. They like don't know what to do. And I just love the pans of, you know, those cameras panning past, like, it looks like many of the people didn't come with dates, but they all want to come to this prom. And you've sort of got the wall of girls and the wall of boys. They're like chewing on their fingernails, or they're like twiddling with their dress or their hair, or like looking down. Nobody's dancing because nobody knows really, like, this is new. Like,
they've
are we
never
supposed
danced.
To be allowed?
Right.
Are
not
we
to mention, it's kind of like this thing you've always been taught not to do. It's kind of like how I feel about pot right now. Like, whenever I smell it anywhere, and even it's legal, like, I get this initial, someone's going to get caught. Like, that's my first response to it. And so, so for them, I'm sure it's a little mixed thing, this thing I've been told I can't do forever. And now's this opportunity.
Oh, it's just such a great scene, though. It's so awkward. Mm-hmm. You just feel so bad for all of them, and they're, it's so cute.
I'll share them all with you, because now we hold.
A really important scene that comes after, I think it's after Almost Paradise and before we get the party going. And that's when the bad boyfriend comes back because, of course, he's pissed that Ren is taking out his girlfriend. And, of course, there is a fight. And Sarah Jessica Parker has made Willard promise not to fight because he's a big fighter. And she's like, this is my night. This is my prom. Don't fight. But those guys play so dirty. They're so dirty. And so finally, poor Willard, he looks at Rusty. He's like on his hands and knees and they're beating him up and he's not fighting back. And he looks at Sarah Jessica Parker and he says, Rusty, what do you want me to do? And she says, kick the son of a bitch's ass. And you're just like, yes. And so not only does Willard kick the bad boyfriend's ass, but then Ren comes out and he kicks ass with his dance moves. Like he uses dance moves to
like
kick.
A dance ninja.
It is. Yeah. It is dance ninja. He uses dance moves to whip Chuck's ass. And then they go in.
That's Footloose starts. The dancing is so great. And then they get into like the Soul Train lines and they're all going down the line.
It's so
now,
great.
Interesting fact about this is much like Pretty in Pink, where that whole ending had to be reshot and redone. Same with Footloose. It actually just kind of ended with like a freeze frame and everybody in the movie theater was starting to get up at the screening and dance. And they realized, oh, we need to make this scene a lot longer.
Yes.
So we need everybody to get up in celebration. Because like I said earlier, the end of this movie is such a celebration. And we are now celebrating feet that are allowed to dance. And that's everybody that has been on this ride and this story with them in the theater, that's you, that's me. We all want to get up and dance. Like I said, I did last week. I had to. I couldn't not. You need the song almost in its entirety. Well, they had to go back and reshoot it. So if you watch the scene again, guess who's not in any of those dance scenes? Sarah Jessica Parker. She was off filming something else. Rusty. So you get a lot of close-ups of Willard doing all his new dance moves. Now you get her at the very beginning when they run in, she's with them because they froze it like right as they all run in originally. But then you would expect when Willard's doing, he's doing, like you said, Kristen, he's doing the boxing with his hand. Yep. He's doing the robot. He gets down, like get down on the floor. They do all this
stuff. It's his moment.
You would expect
it is his
shots
moment.
Of Rusty going out of her mind with excitement and glee and so proud of him. You don't see Sarah Jessica Parker in any of those scenes.
No way. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Interesting.
And that's the natural progression because they're out there after they kick everyone's ass.
Yes.
They go in for the scene where he's like, I thought this was a party. Let's dance. Cue Footloose.
It makes me sad because I would have loved to have seen her be so excited.
Yeah. I know.
Just so gleeful watching Willard dance, right? And dancing with him. But regardless of that, it's such a great scene. And I love when you get to see, you know, it showcases different. Different people, different
everybody,
students dancing.
Everybody
so
gets
fun.
To do their thing. And I just like them.
And glitter is just like glitter. It's like a glitter bomb
just
constantly. It's like
flying.
A machine. Somebody brought in a glitter machine because it's just going and it's so good.
It's so great. It's so great. This scene is really Willard's triumph right here. And I think it's a credit to the director that we didn't notice that Sarah Jessica Parker wasn't there.
I was just going to say that. I didn't notice that until you just, well, I've only seen it once, but I wasn't missing her. I wasn't looking for her on the screen. So
that's good for that. I think we have not talked about Footloose previously because it's almost too familiar, right? Like we know it so well. What is there to talk about? But watching this week, I think, like you said in the beginning, Michelle, I think it means more to us today than it did then. Because back then we were like, who would ban a book? Who would do that?
Yeah.
Who would burn a book too? Yeah.
Who would burn a book? There's a whole book burning scene. And now this is what's happening here. It really exposes how fear of the unknown, fear of looking foolish, fear of losing the people you love, fear of people who are not like you drives us to be mean. Mm-hmm. Mean to outsiders, mean to each other. And if you look at the songs from the soundtrack, it reads kind of like a manifesto for living your life. You gotta cut Footloose, holding out for a hero. Let's hear it for the boy or the girl. I'm free, almost paradise. Watch it today. Everybody, watch it today. It might hit different. Thank you so much for listening today, and we will see you next time.
I loved this episode, y'all. I loved having this conversation. This was really fun. And before we go, we want to say a genuine thank you to our Patreon members. Your support means everything to us. You help keep this show going. And being part of this community feels a lot like the best Gen X moments. Trading mixtapes, hanging out until the streetlights came on, rewinding the tape just right. Dancing to Footloose, right? We're so grateful you're with us. And we can't tell you how much we appreciate your support. Today, we're giving a special shout out to these patrons: Carolyn, Jennifer, Cindy, Colette, Sharon, Susan, Helene, Christina, Heather, Jill, Elizabeth, Claire, Susan, and Lance.
Love it.
Yes, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
Two happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie. Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers, everyone.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.
Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did.